Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All right, we're going to raise a glass of virtual champagne to Wayne Barrett here in just a second. But good morning, everyone. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And just want to plant this phone number and this web address in your brains, hopefully for you, sometime this morning. I'm not going to dwell on it right now, but this is day one of our winter membership drive. And people, we are trying to raise a whole lot of money toward our election campaign coverage expenses. So if you appreciate what you've been hearing on this show and around the station, election-wise, and of course, for everything that WNYC does through the week, we hope you'll make a pledge to 1-888-376-WNYC, if not now, sometime this morning, to 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org. You can see lots of thank you gifts and stuff online. Go over to WNYC.org there and check it all out. And we hope you will support WNYC one time in 2008. So thank you all for considering it. Now, we welcome our first guest today with a round of congratulations. Wayne Barrett, the investigative reporter and political columnist, is celebrating his 30th anniversary at the Village Voice. He started there in January, was it, of 1978, 30 years and a few days.
Well, I wrote some freelance pieces prior to that, but they gave me the Running Scared column in January of 1978.
So Wayne has written books on the scandals during the Koch administration, on Donald Trump, and on Rudy Giuliani. He started out as a fan of Giuliani, but became probably his fiercest media critic. Wayne has called out New York's worst landlords, become a leading defender of Governor Spitzer on the Troopergate affair, believing that it's being blown way out of proportion while Joe Bruno's corruption is being downplayed by the press. He also teaches at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism these days, and a check of our archives yesterday revealed that Wayne Barrett has been a guest on this show more than 20 times. So on the occasion of his 30th anniversary at The Voice, it's my pleasure to welcome back yet again for a romp through the present and the past. So let me ask you first, are you experiencing the demise of the Giuliani for President campaign as a personal success?
No, not really. I think I had a little role in it, and I certainly don't mind that he's out of the game. But, you know, the day after the Florida primary, after watching him lose in Florida, I was on Amy Goodman's show, if I can mention another show, and I was walking past the United States Attorney's office where I had sat with him for hours, countless numbers of times, and I felt a little tug of the heart for the old Rudy, because the old Rudy in the U.S. Attorney's office, you know, it's a mixed record. He has his critics, but I'm still one of those who believes that he was an outstanding United States attorney. And it's kind of funny in American politics where you can rise to the near presidency and be a shadow of your former self, but that's really what I believe he was. I believe he was a much better man when I knew him as a young man and as a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's office.
What made him a good U.S. attorney, in your opinion, and did he change, did you change, or what happened there?
Well, I'm still married to the same woman 39 years later. I'm still working at the same paper. I still think I have exactly the same feelings about the public issues that I covered when I covered him so favorably, really, as a U.S. attorney. So my hunch would be that he changed a lot more than I did. I also think that, you know, I had some blind spots about him in those days. He was, after all, prosecuting very effectively the kind of corrupt New York politicians that I had been writing about for years prior to his arrival on the scene. And so seeing him, I think we bonded over people like Donnie Manus and Stanley Friedman and some of the folks that he prosecuted that were ripping off the public trow here in New York. And you know, I knew something about their political backgrounds and where they fit in the game. And he, of course, knew a great deal about their individual crimes. But I'll never forget that the day that Stanley Friedman, the boss of the Bronx, at one time the state Democratic chairman and certainly the most powerful party leader in the state at the time that Rudy prosecuted him, when Rudy cross-examined him at that trial in New Haven, you can ask questions at when the defendant takes the stand that go beyond the four corners of the indictment, as they put it. You can ask about what they call similar acts. And the first five or six questions that Rudy asked Stanley Friedman all came from my stories. Mm. And I sat there in the courtroom with a chill because they really were a series of my best hits on Stanley Friedman over the years. In fact, the question that many people thought convicted Stanley when he was asked about whether or not he made two phone calls to rig a lease for one of his clients, and he corrected Rudy and said it was only one phone call, was I who had written about that lease. Huh.
And did Giuliani give you credit at the time?
Directly? I don't know. No, we didn't sit around swapping praise. We really didn't.
But did you sit around swapping stories? Were you, you know, some reporters have closer relationships to
I had a close relationship with him, but I don't remember us ever discussing his cross-examination. Yeah. I don't think that ever came up.
Now, Andrew Bernstein was on with me on Tuesday night from Clinton headquarters during the election returns. And I gather you were also at Clinton headquarters. And Andrea said something that really astonished me, that you were throwing out your Rudy Giuliani files.
Yes, yes. I wrote a farewell to Rudy for this week's Voice. And I spent the weekend going through my office at home has been just overwhelmed with Giuliani paper. There's no room for Bloomberg paper in it. There's no room for Spitzer paper.
You've written two books about Rudy Giuliani, including the one that was really, I guess, aimed at the rest of America, trying to pull back the curtain off the easy illusion of his America's mayor image called Grand Illusion.
Right. Right. And so I did spend the weekend not throwing out everything, but certainly throwing out a great deal and moving the rest of it to the basement. So I was pretty confident when I wrote that funeral piece that, you know, that we've at least seen the end of his public career.
Really? Because Rudy Giuliani, he's buds with John McCain, and who knows if he's not going to wind up as the next Attorney General of the United States?
Well, you know, I thought it was very interesting that when McCain had his big victory speech the night of Super Tuesday, he mentioned and thanked the governor of California, thanked many other people, but he never mentioned Rudy. And, you know, I think Rudy overstayed his welcome already with John McCain. Probably if you read the books about John McCain, he actually said that the years that he went through over the Keating Five scandal, you remember his involvement in the savings and loan scandal, were worse than the years that he spent in the Hanoi prison. So when Rudy got into an exchange with him using Randy Mastro as his mouthpiece during the campaign.
Rudy aid Randy Mastro. Uh-huh.
Yes, yes. And Randy Mastro responded to McCain's critical comments about Bernie Kerik's indictment, responded to it by raising the specter of the Keating scandal and putting it on the table again. I don't think that John McCain is likely to forget that.
Yeah. Wayne Barrett is my guest on WNYC on the occasion of his 30th anniversary of starting a Village Voice column. And you started there just as Ed Koch was starting his mayoralty. The city was in fiscal crisis. Crime was spiking. Billy Martin was managing the Yankees. I guess you've already talked about some of it, but your first big book a few years later was with Jack Newfield called City for Sale, Ed Koch and the Betrayal of New York. Who betrayed New York?
Well, you know, the theory of the City for Sale book, which Jack is now dead, and Jack is the person who brought me to The Voice, so let me just say a hello to my dear friend who is now dead. But Jack and I did this book, and I think the theory of the book in terms of Koch was obviously that he was not complicit in the criminality of Stanley Friedman and Donald Manus. There was never any question about that, but the compromise that he entered into really from the day that he met with Meade Esposito, the boss of Brooklyn in 1977, to get Meade's support in the runoff against Mario Cuomo, a very critical moment in his career. The compromise that he made there, which and the compromise he made with Stanley Friedman, the boss of the Bronx, in the same time frame. Stanley Friedman had been supporting Abe Beame in the primary, and he switched to Ed Koch. Those kinds of compromises that he made really opened the door of his administration, because maybe Ed Koch, even though he was reared in the village district of Carmine DiSapio, maybe he didn't understand that if you give those guys critical posts in your administration, you let them name the guys who are going to run the Department of Transportation, run the Parking Violations Bureau, run the leasing portion, for example, of the city government. If you let Meade Esposito and Stanley Friedman and Donald Manus name the people who run those operations, they are only interested in the business that they can get out of those operations, and they sure did get it. So it was that fundamental compromise that we thought betrayed the city.
So does the city learn from these things? Does the next generation of politicians learn from these things? Or do we see the same patterns repeat themselves with other individuals?
Well, the great consequence, really, of the City for Sale scandal. And some of the credit goes to Rudy Giuliani. Some of the credit goes to Ed McDonnell, for example, who was the head of the Organized Crime Task Force in the Eastern District of New York in Brooklyn and who prosecuted Meade Esposito. But as a result of the City for Sale scandal, the machine has never been the same. The bosses that ran New York politics, the Donald Manuses, the Stanley Friedmans, the Meade Espositos, they are gone. We do not have bosses that operate at that level anymore and control the politics of New York. And the way in which they really did, as recently as the Koch administration, I think that's one of the reasons I still think Rudy was an outstanding United States attorney in many ways, is he helped transform the politics of New York by ending the reign of the machines. I don't think he's the only prosecutor who deserves credit for that, but I certainly think that's part of his role. So I do think we learned something from it.
What's the story of how you get to see the city after 30 years as an investigative reporter? You investigated the Koch administration, the Giuliani administration, famously, but I've got a whole list here of things that you've done. You investigated a David Dinkins stock transaction when he was running for mayor, and Andrew Cuomo's law practice back in the 1980s. Guys you call poverty barons, Democratic leaders like Clarence Norman and Denny Farrell. So you dig into people from both parties, certainly. But does it make you see the city and life in the city in a certain jaundiced way?
I'm a country boy from Lynchburg, Virginia. And
are you really?
Yes, and I still have Jerry Falwell's hometown is my hometown. So I still have an awful lot of the country boy naivete in me, and I always expect tomorrow's going to be a better day. I don't think I'm jaded in any way by this, really. I think I've seen outstanding people in public life in New York. I've written critical stories about the people I regard as outstanding. I would say Ruth Messenger, Mark Green are two of the outstanding people I've covered over the years. But you look at my copy on them, I probably wrote the toughest copy on them that was written.
No doubt.
And,
some of it anyway.
Yeah, I do believe that there are good people and there are bad people in politics. I also believe there are good people who do bad things in politics, who need to be upbraided for that and need to be examined. When I have wear two hats really at The Voice. One is as a kind of occasional political commentator where I write political copy where my political biases are very apparent. But you just mentioned, for example, the inner city broadcasting story of the 1989 campaign. Rudy Giuliani probably would have never been mayor but for that story. And then when I wrote the stories while Dinkins was mayor about the Parking Violations Bureau under his own administration. I think it was the biggest scandal of the Dinkins administration. So, I wrote stories, headlined cover stories called the Cuomo Sleaze Team. So I when I do an investigative piece, the politics of the subjects of those stories, the politics, the ideology of them doesn't matter to me at all. I don't think you'll ever find a more liberal speaker in New York than Mel Miller was, and I wrote the stories that led to his indictment.
Speaker of the Assembly. All right, we will continue with Wayne Barrett on the occasion of his 30th anniversary at the Village Voice. I want you to tell the story when we come back of when you and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein got thrown out of a George Pataki fundraiser. I want to get your take on the current Democratic primary race. I want to know what's the least understood thing about New York politics that you wish people could understand better. And more as we continue with Wayne Barrett, now 30 years at the Village Voice, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thank you. on WNYC, and we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of Wayne Barrett as an investigative reporter and political columnist for The Village Voice. He started 30 years ago last month. In 1992, you wrote a book about Donald Trump.
I did.
Now, he's a businessman, not a politician. Why'd you write a book about Trump?
You know, I say in the introduction of that book that in some ways the book is part of a series, which doesn't seem natural because the series that I say it's part of is City for Sale.
Which was about the scandals during the Koch administration.
Right, and then I link it later up with the first Giuliani book I did, which the reason is because I used Trump as a window, really, into the politics of both New York and New Jersey. Many of the chapters are about how he built his empire in Atlantic City. But this book was – so it is a book in some ways about an American businessman. But in many, many ways, it's really a continuation of my work on New York and, in this case, New York and New Jersey politics, because Donald Trump is the consummate state capitalist. He really is somebody who was created – by both his father's and his own connections in New York politics and then in Jersey politics. So in some ways, it's a continuation of the beat that I've been on. I wrote the book as a result of the fact that I had written a three-part series on him in the 70s when he first really was a rookie in New York development. And that series led to the impaneling of a grand jury and investigation of him in the United States Attorney's Office in the Eastern District. I think it was the toughest run he ever had. He was obviously not indicted, but the series raised an awful lot of questions about how he conducted business, and it was all about political relationships.
You know, if you played your cards right, he might have taken you on as an apprentice.
That's right. That's right. Well, he offered me an apartment, as a matter of fact.
Is that right?
Actually, yes, while I was doing the series.
While I was doing the series. Was that a bribe?
I certainly thought so. He not only that, I lived in Ocean Hill, Brownsville for 15 years, right? And he says to me, Wayne, you don't have to live in Brownsville. You know, and I have plenty of apartments for you, Wayne. And so I, you know, it was
Trump,
Donald being Donald.
Beyond Donald, does he signify something important about New York beyond himself?
Well, sure. Look, the most fascinating part of Donald Trump is his father, Fred Trump. In many ways, Donald has been a struggle all his life to try to equal, and I think he failed to equal the achievements of his father. Fred Trump built 20,000 apartments for real people in New York, not Casbahs for rich folks or corporations. You look at some of Donald's buildings, and you go there in the middle of the night, the one that's on Central Park West, and there are no lights on in the building because nobody's living there. These are corporate apartments. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought that the most interesting thing about Donald was that he built his empire really through the political relationships of his father. And his father, I remember interviewing Joe Sharkey, who was, believe it or not, the Brooklyn County leader in the 1930s. And he was still alive when I did this book, and he was in his 90s. And he was hard of hearing, but he had a very quick mind. And so I said to him, when did you first see Fred Trump at the FHA? Because every project that Fred Trump had ever done was funded by the FHA. And he said, I went down to the Roosevelt inaugural. And after the inaugural, I went over to the FHA and Fred Trump was already there. And I said to him, which one, meaning which Roosevelt inaugural? And he said, Franklin. I guess he had been at Teddy's.
So there's that term you used, state capitalists.
Yes, yes.
State capitalists. All right, we can take phone calls for Wayne Barrett on the air. You can ask him about anything he's ever written or that you might have even imagined that he's ever written over the last 30 years at The Village Voice, 212-433-WNYC. And, of course, even though we're in our fundraiser, we'll never ask for money on the air, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you want to talk to Wayne Barrett about his body of work this morning. Is there anything you would say is the least understood thing about New York politics that you wish people could understand better?
I wish people could understand you know, it's a very ironic thing coming from a liberal newspaper, and I consider myself a democratic liberal myself, but I think the misunderstood thing is about how municipal labor shapes municipal services. And, you know, you just can't break through on that. I mean, I think the consummate one is the teachers' union, where we actually have a school system which, by and large, is there to service the people that work there. And I'm not saying it hasn't gotten better. It has definitely gotten better in my lifetime. I'm not saying that Randy Weingarten isn't a tremendous improvement over Al Sharpton. I mean, Al Shanker, excuse me, Al Sharpton.
But, I didn't know he ran the teachers' union.
Yes. But I am saying that there is a way, and it's a way that never quite comes across in terms of the coverage of New York politics. There is a way in which municipal labor has a detrimental general impact on the delivery of municipal services that just is continuous and does not get understood and translated in New York media well enough.
What can anybody do about that?
I've tried. You know, I have tried. I'm certainly not the favored journalist of municipal labor unions, but I have tried. I did a series in the Bloomberg administration in the first term as a result of 9/11 and as a result of the debacle that Giuliani left the city's fiscal situation in minus 9/11. Bloomberg inherited an enormously difficult fiscal problem. I thought he dealt with it as effectively as I've ever seen a chief executive, either state or local, that I've covered deal with it. I thought he dealt with it with remarkable success. But the one player that would never cooperate and never help was municipal labor. So I did five or six stories in that time period about what the municipal labor unions were failing to do to help the city in this moment of very dark times.
That's fascinating. We'll go to some of our callers in a minute. A lot of people want to talk to you, but tell us that story about how you and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein once got thrown out of a Pataki for Governor fundraiser.
Well, I got arrested. I don't think Andrea did.
But you got arrested?
I got arrested that night. Yeah, it was at the Waldorf Astoria, and we were not even trying to get into the fundraiser. We were simply in the elevator lobby trying to corner people as they got off the elevator to go to the fundraiser. Now, the interesting thing about the fundraiser was that it was a fundraiser that was a very exclusive one. You had to have raised, mind you, not contributed, at least raised $100,000 for Pataki to make it into this room. So there's no way from a campaign filing at the state level that you can figure out who raised it. All you can figure out is who gave it from a campaign filing. That's different in the city level, where what's called bundlers have to be disclosed at a city level, but not at a state level. So Andrea and I were determined to try to see who had actually raised at least $100,000 for George Pataki.
Because they were in the room.
Yeah, the only way to do that, since they wouldn't allow reporters in the room, was to stand in the elevator, outside the elevator, which was clearly not. It was a good distance away from the ballroom where this, but they had to get off that elevator. So Andrea and I were there, and they kept telling us we had to move. And I ultimately refused to move and got arrested there. And the arrest was thrown out in court a few days later, but it did serve. You know, it's never pleasant to have handcuffs put on your wrists. You mentioned Donald Trump. He had me arrested at his birthday party in Atlantic City, and they handcuffed me. Yeah, they handcuffed me to the wall all night because there isn't a cop in Atlantic City that doesn't moonlight for Donald Trump. So the cop that arrested me was moonlighting for Donald Trump and handcuffed me. Now, this was a birthday party that everybody was allowed in but me. In fact, my research assistant, who they couldn't identify by picture, he went in and spent the whole night in the birthday party. But
he crashed the party?
Yes, they arrested me inside of it, threw handcuffs on me, and hauled me out. And then they handcuffed me to the wall for the entire night. It's never pleasant.
There's a television series in this. Everybody loves Wayne.
Ken
in Edison, you're on WNYC with Wayne Barrett. Hi, Ken.
Hello there. How are you doing? I really like your show very much.
Thank you very much.
Wayne, you do a great job there.
Thank you.
I had a question on your 30 years of doing this kind of journalism. Who is the worst character you've ever had to deal with in New York City? And I'm going to hang up and listen, boys.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that's a tough one.
That's a hard one, right?
That's a tough one.
How would you measure? Start with criteria.
I would say that the worst thing that I see a scale politician do is involve his own children in his criminality. It's one thing to be a self-serving scale of a politician, rip off the public trial to make things better for your own children so they don't have to do it, I guess, in some corner of your mind. But when Meade Esposito, the boss of Brooklyn, involved his daughter, when Mario Biaggi, the congressman from the Bronx, who was such a power in the city, involved his son in some of his own criminality, I think that's about as low as you can sink in terms of, Meade Esposito had this, he was the most powerful boss in the state for a long time, and I had been chasing him and on the running, doing stories on him for a very long time, and he would never return my call, but if he saw me, he couldn't stop talking to me. And I once went to his office in Brooklyn just to get some records there, and he saw me in the outer office. He called me, and now Meade is really, he's dead now, but he is a walking one-man crime wave.
We are talking with Wayne Barrett, Village Voice investigative reporter and political columnist, on the occasion of his 30th anniversary at The Voice, and taking some phone calls for him. We're also in day one of our winter fundraiser. We have a few minutes left with Wayne, and we hope all that's going on, you'll go over to WNYC.org and make a contribution or call 1-888-376-9692. Thanks, all of you, for your support. And Rita in Jamaica, you're on WNYC with Wayne Barrett. Hi, Rita.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
Well, I just wanted to thank Wayne Barrett for all of his years of reporting, but mainly just to thank him for mentioning Mr. Fred Trump and not Donald, because I live in a building that was once owned by Fred Trump, and I remember he used to come up, drive up in his long limousine, and come out and greet people coming out of the building and ask them, how do you like living here? What can we do better? And we are all working class people. I'm African American of all ethnicities, and so you'd never get Donald, but Fred, up into his just later years, was always there for us. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much for mentioning Fred.
Thank you very much.
Well, just in case she doesn't know, Fred and Donald had to be sued by the United States government because on a discrimination lawsuit before they opened up their housing complexes. This is when Donald was working for Fred and running those 20,000 apartment units. But they did have racially discriminatory practices, and they ultimately reached a settlement with the United States government to open up their housing complexes for African Americans and others.
John in Paramus, you're on WNYC with Wayne Barrett. Hi, John.
How you doing? Great show and great columns for 30 years. It's been really fun, interesting reading you. I'd like to know if Hillary wins, who will they appoint as U.S. Senator, and do you think Rudy will run for governor or the Senate, her Senate seat?
No, I'm throwing away those files because I'm convinced that Rudy is out of public life. I don't see him running for anything. He hasn't, the last time he ran was 97, and even though he had a very large margin, he actually had the lowest total vote of any mayor elected in the 20th century. He has not been a tremendously successful politician, despite all of the hoopla. I don't expect him to run again, and I expect that he's going to just try to revive that business of his.
And he asked who would be appointed by Governor Spitzer to fill out the term in the U.S. Senate. Any prediction on that, if Clinton is elected president?
I really do believe it's going to be David Patterson. I think if Spitzer is running for re-election, and he has certain weaknesses already in the African-American community, that if he were to appoint anybody else, he would be in big trouble on a re-election race.
Have you been looking at the Super Tuesday results from the voting in New York? I wonder if you're parsing any lessons to be gleaned from the vote as to who we are as a city, or who the Democratic Party New York is as an electorate, or how we're changing?
Well, I thought it was really remarkable that Hillary got 4 out of 10 black votes in New York, which Michael Powell reported in the Times. And
we talked about it. Two out of 10 nationally, 4 out of 10 in New York.
Yeah, I think that's pretty remarkable tribute to her as a senator, considering the enormous charisma of her black opponent. I think it's a real enormous tribute to her. And, I find this election to be, I really didn't know who I was going to vote for till I pulled the curtain, and it was an extremely difficult choice. And I think many New Yorkers and many Americans are having, many Democrats are having this difficult choice. To me, the only real question is who can carry Ohio or Florida. And, you know, I'm very, very concerned. It's remarkable to me how little the press has paid attention to it. But in that last debate, Obama really came out for driver's licenses for illegals in extremely strong terms. Now, John McCain is in a very weak position to raise the immigration issue, but not on driver's licenses. And, you know, I think it's going to be that's going to be baggage for Obama to carry in November in certain states, Ohio being one.
So are you saying that you voted for Hillary? I don't know if you're coming out publicly with your vote, that you voted for her and based on electability?
Well, no, I really don't want to talk about it. It feels such private. You know, I haven't even told my wife, who is definitely a Hillary fan, and I feel like it's such an extraordinarily difficult choice. I certainly have a fundamental problem with Hillary Clinton's approach to the war, and I think everything she has said about it has been one falsehood atop another on the debate, in the latest debates as well. So it's a fundamental. I have a fundamental problem with her on that. But at the same time, the question to me is, after 7 or 8 years of George Bush, I just do not see how the country or the planet can tolerate the possibility of another 4 years of these guys. I think it's extremely important that a Democrat win this time. And so the choice to me has to be made on an electability basis, and that's like reading tea leaves sometimes, or a leap of faith. Sometimes.
One other issue before you go. You have been one of the biggest defenders of Governor Spitzer on the Troopergate affair, and one of the biggest critics of the ethics of Joe Bruno, the Senate Republican leader who the Troopergate scheme was aimed at. What do you think is out of whack in the way people are looking at that?
Well, you know, the most recent stories really tell it, that we now have a renewed federal investigation of Joe Bruno. And look, Andrew Cuomo originally agreed to a $10,000 contribution limit when Governor Spitzer voluntarily imposed it on himself. He has now, in the last few months, thrown that aside and just held a fundraiser with a $25,000 contribution limit. Well, nobody thinks that he needs to change the contribution limit to run for attorney general again. He might not even have a significant opponent. So why did he change the dollar amount that he's willing to raise? Because he's thinking about running for governor. Doesn't that put his, I think, very shoddy report in a totally different light, since soon afterwards he changes the contribution limit to prepare for a possible race? I don't think he's made up his mind to run against Spitzer. It's going to depend on vulnerability, but he certainly is considering it. And I think that puts what I think was a very shoddy report in the political light in which it belongs.
Wayne Barrett, celebrating his 30th anniversary at the Village Voice. He's been on the show more than 20 times, and we may well head for 30 ourselves if you keep at it long enough. Wayne Barrett, congratulations, and thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for asking, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. John Kerry, our next guest.